Oral History Project. My name is Jessica Daniels, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing Mr. William D. Daniels. Today's date is November 27th, 2002. First of all, I would like you to just tell a little bit about your life, just interesting things of like where you grew up, and just some fun things you did as a child.
Well, I was born on a farm in Rookstown in Kansas, December 22nd, 1922. We moved around on different farms. My dad ran a different farm. Milk cows, had a garden, had chickens to make a living back then. And it ended up I was the oldest of seven. My youngest sister was born after I had left home. So I didn't see her then until Christmas after she was born in November, which, you know, would be about 6 weeks or so. But anyway, as we were going up, we had milk cows, and each of us, there must have been four of us kids old enough to milk cows. And each of us had one or two cows that we milked night and morning. And we brought the milk to the house, run it through a separator, separate the cream from the milk, fed the milk to the hogs, and took the cream to town, sold for groceries. Then I started to school, of course, before I was six, when I was five, going on six, in a one-room schoolhouse. It was called Bethel School in northern Rooks County. I stayed there for 3 years. Then we moved southwest of Stockton, Kansas, and I rode a bus to Webster School. Walked about a mile to a bus in the morning, and then they brought us home in the evening, and we walked a mile back home. My sister Virginia was in the first grade, and I was in the fourth grade. No, she was in the second grade, and I was in the fourth grade when we moved down there. Quite interesting. I learned, of course, my dad and my uncle played baseball for town teams. My dad was a catcher, and my uncle was a pitcher. So growing up, I attended baseball games almost every Sunday in the summertime, watching my dad and uncle play baseball. And of course, I would chase, they would hit a foul ball, and I would go and get the foul balls, and the manager of the team would give me a nickel for every foul ball I brought back. I didn't get very wealthy, but I made a little spending money, you see. And Webster was a consolidated school that had one of the first consolidated schools in Kansas, I believe. And they ran school buses out in the country to pick the kids up. We didn't have kindergarten in those days, but they were first grade through high school at Webster. Before I moved to Webster, one of the football players got hurt real bad playing football, so they never played football after that at Webster. They played soccer instead. However, I never learned to play soccer. I watched them, but I never did learn how.
Why didn't you play soccer? Why didn't you play soccer?
I don't know. I guess I wasn't very interested in it. But we, at recess and at noon, we played baseball. We had school plays, you know, at Christmas and on holidays, where the kids were characters in plays. I remember one time I was going to be in a play, and we had two kids with a horse's skin. One, you know, they bent over like a horse. Mm-hmm. So playfully, I lifted the horse's tail and like that, The teacher threw me out. She wouldn't let me be in the play. No more. That was it. She tossed me out. I had thought of that for years. But anyway, then, after I got out of the sixth grade, of course, Brother Bob then had ridden the bus with us for a couple of years. He's 2 years younger than my sister Virginia. Well, he started 2 years after she did. He was in the first grade, I guess. So then we moved from south of the river, west of Stockton, and moved to a farm south and west of where I was born. And there was a hill called White Mound, which is visible for many miles in every direction. It was in our pasture.
Why was it called White Mound?
You know, it had a lot of limestone rocks on the sides, and it was the biggest hill, tallest hill around in that country up there.
And it was like where you lived?
Yeah, in our pasture. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we moved up there, and Dad drove the horses and a wagon. I drove the milk cows walking. And Mother drove the car that we had. I think it was a 28 Oldsmobile. Pretty good car for those days. And we arrived up there then. And then the following fall, I went to school at a school called Pleasant Valley. It was a one-teacher school with 8 grades. I was the only one in the 7th grade. And then the next year, I was the only one in the 8th grade. But when we graduated in 8th grade in those days, he went to the county seat and took an exam. So I passed the exam, and so the next year, then I could go to high school.
Was that kind of like your graduation thing? You had to pass the test to get out to high school?
Sort of. Yeah. So, for 2.5 a week, I stayed with a lady and her grandson for room and board, 2.5 a week, and then walked probably 10 blocks to school. I stayed there for just 1 year. Then I went out for football. Yeah. I don't remember. I think Dad gave me 25 cents a week for spending money. In those days, 25 cents, why do you buy a nickel candy bar, you know, a nickel bottle of pop? So it went quite a way. I learned how to shoot pool then when I was there. And if you lost the game, you had to pay. And if you won the game, you didn't have to pay. So there's quite a good incentive to win. So I got pretty good at pool shooting.
What did you take in high school?
No, I took general courses, English, history. I think chemistry.
Vocational.
No shop. We didn't have vocational ed then. Not when I started. Went in to take typing, and we only had so many typewriters, and there were more girls than there were typewriters, so we let the girls have the typewriters. So I never learned how to type.
So what did you do instead?
Oh, I had another class, I suppose. Day was pretty well filled.
Where did you work? When you were going to high school, you worked someplace, didn't you?
Not then. I didn't work. I didn't work till I was a senior.
That's what I mean.
But then the sophomore and junior years, I stayed with Mrs. White. And it was still just 2.5 a week from a room and board. And Dad still gave me a quarter a week to spend. And still played football and woodworking in the shop. I made a piano bench for my granddad and Aunt Mae. I remember. And of course they paid for the materials. You know, they made it out of walnut.
Your Aunt Mae?
Well, she was my grandfather's second wife.
Okay.
My grandmother died of diabetes in about 1928 or 29. And granddad married Aunt Mae then in about 1930. Or somewhere near.
Was your football team good?
I can't remember from the time I was a sophomore till after I graduated. I can't remember winning a single game. We tied Woodson once. We had a successful season that year.
How many guys did you have on your team?
Well, of course, there's 11.
Yeah.
Like we have today. So then, when I was a senior, a fellow had offered me a job milking cows and helping deliver milk and helping him in a dairy. I mean, it's one family dairy. We milked 12 cows, I believe it was. He milked 6 and I milked 6. Night and morning. And we run the milk through a strainer and bottled it in quart bottles. And in the evening, I went with him, and he would drive to the houses, and I would take the bottles out of the back of the car and take them up and set them on the porch of the house, bring the empty bottles back. I think we sold it for 10 cents a quart. I think that's what he got, 10 cents a quart.
So did you just get part of that wage every...
No. I didn't get any of the wage. No. Now, when I was a senior, the federal government came out with a program called NYA, where students could work, grade papers and stuff, for so much an hour.
What does NYA stand for?
National Youth Administration. Well, I think I made $8 or $10 a month that way. And the fellow I worked for let me use his Model A Ford pickup to drive to school. It was out in the country where it was. Oh, about two or 3 miles north of town. So I could drive that pickup. So I was right uptown, you see, with a vehicle. Had to beat the girls off at the club.
They wanted to ride in your cool truck.
Oh, yeah. Well, it wasn't quite that good. But anyway, then, about the time I graduated then, that spring, graduated from high school, the fellow sold the dairy and got into the grocery business, the Clover Farm Stores, we called it in those days. So I went to work for him in the grocery store. And about that same time, the folks decided to quit farming, so they sold everything out and moved to a house south of town. This place belonged to my sister Virginia, had worked for these people all her high school time, and they milked cows, and she helped with the milking and stuff, you know. But they had a telephone on the wall, but it wouldn't work. It didn't have any battery, and the wires were disconnected. So I got some batteries and hooked the wires up, you know, so we had a telephone. Now, I don't know if it was legal or not, or how they arranged to pay for it, but anyway, we had a telephone. So I got, working in the grocery store, I got $8 a week. I worked from 8 in the morning till 4 or 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the evening, every day. And on Saturday, we stayed open till midnight. I got $8 a week, which was, pretty good in those days. Anyway, I bought a bicycle so that I could ride from the house into town and work.
Were you just a grocery sacker?
Oh, we put stuff on the shelves, you know, and marked up prices and whatever it does in a grocery store.
But with your earnings, you bought a bike for yourself?
You bet. And I left it behind, and my brothers and sisters, I think, rode that old bike till, even Sister Nancy, I think, rode the old thing. Bikes don't wear out very, very easy. So, the store was in trouble, and he had to sell out then about in the fall. So I was out of a job. So the Navy was hollering for recruits.
Not the Navy.
The Navy.
Okay.
I haven't ever told you this story.
Okay.
So anyway, I saw there's a Rainbow Bread truck in town, and they went to Salina every day. They delivered bread from Salina to Stockton, and then they went back to Salina. So I asked the guy if I could ride back with him. He said, no, you can't. That's company policy. That was the nearest Navy recruiter was Salina. So the next morning I got out on the highway and held my thumb up, and I hitchhiked to Salina. And I don't know, I started in the morning, got down there in the middle of the afternoon, and I don't remember how I found the recruiting office, but anyway, I got there. And the first question the guy asked me, he said, how old are you? I said, I'm 17. He said, I can't take you. Go on. He ain't old enough. So I hitchhiked back home. And by that time, it was getting dark, and we got to Hayes, and the fellow I was riding with offered to let me stay with him overnight, which I did, and then hitchhiked on home the next day.
Was the age limit 18?
Yeah, to get in.
Yeah, to get in. Well, you could lie about your age, and if your parents were silent, well, you could get in, but I didn't. But there were some neighbor boys that were home from a CC camp, Civilian Conservation Corps. And they made it sound pretty good. You got paid $30 a month, and 25 of them went home to the family, and you got $5 a month to spend. That sounded pretty good to me. So I went up, and four or five of us went in together, and we signed up for the CCCs.
Who were the other guys?
I don't remember. I think one of them was DeMardo. They were French people at DeMar, and he was from DeMar. DeMardo was his name. And I don't remember the other's names. And I don't remember if we rode the train from Stockton or from Hayes. But anyway, we got on the train, and we went to Alcester, South Dakota, which is about 40 miles north of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, on this side of the river, and Sioux City, Iowa, on the other side of the river, right side by side. So Alcester, eastern South Dakota. And I remember we went through the depot in Kansas City to change trains. And we went up some stairs or downstairs. Then we went on to Omaha, Nebraska, and changed trains there, and we had to go upstairs. But they had an escalator there. First escalator I'd ever seen.
Did you ride on it right away?
You bet. We rode that thing up and rode it back down. Up and yes. So then we went on to Alcester on the train. That's the first time that I had ever been on a train. First time I'd ever ridden on a train.
How much did it cost?
It didn't cost me anything. The government sent me up there.
That's good.
So I stayed at Alcester then for, and I can't remember how long, a month or two maybe. But anyway, the work was to plant windbreaks and clean up fence rows, build fence, stuff like that. That was our job. But anyway, they decided that they didn't need us there anymore, so they sent us to Custer, South Dakota, which is up in the Black Hills. And we did forestry work up there. In the summertime, we thinned timber, thinned it out, you know, and made posts out of the ones that cut them into posts, and then they reassembled those posts. And in the wintertime, we made fire trails on the ridges, 150, 300 feet wide. We burnt all of the dry brush, all the dry trees, cut down all the dry old dead trees, along this ridge for fire breaks, you see, in the summertime. That was our job. And then they had crews building roads, keeping the roads smooth. So I decided I want to join the Navy again. So went down to Custer, and I was 18 by then, you see. And started signing up, and I'll be damned if I didn't get the mumps. And they quarantined me for 6 weeks with the mumps. So I decided to let the Navy go. So one time I went down to the PX, and that's where we shot pool, you know, and drank our Cokes and whatnot. I don't think we drank beer. I don't think we had beer. I don't remember. I never did drink beer until I was in the Marine Corps. But anyway, one night these boys come by in these Marine dress blues. I mean, they were pretty uniform. Blue pants, you know, with a white strip up the side. Pretty white hats. And I thought, oh, that's the outfit for me. So I applied then for the Marine Corps. And I'll be damned if I didn't get the measles.
Well, you just had everything.
And they sent me up to an Army hospital near Rapid City for 6 weeks with them measles.
So you were out for 12 weeks?
Yeah.
Yeah, 6 weeks.
Man.
And so when I finally got over the measles and went back to camp, I still wanted to go to the Marine Corps, so I don't know how we worked it out. But anyway, we did. And we went to Rapid City for examinations. And, well, they made sure you could read and write, you know, and give you questionnaires. Passed all those exams.
How long were the questionnaires?
Oh, I don't know, one or two pages. Pretty good exam. And then, there was about 5 or 6 of us passed those. So they sent us to Minneapolis, Minnesota, the nearest Marine, you know, where they take Marines in. And went through a set of examinations again there. And out of the 6 of us, there were 3 of us that got in. So we went from Minneapolis, Minnesota on the train to San Diego, California.
How come the other 3 didn't get in?
Either they couldn't pass the mental exam or physical. I don't know. I don't know. Never kind of make any difference. So I noticed when we went into the Marine Corps base then in San Diego, they had these, they called them long toms, 155 millimeter cannon.
Long toms?
Long toms, they called them. And then they had hard rubber tires. They were World War I weapons. And they always said Marine Corps never threw anything away. We kept everything, you know, and used it. So anyway, I think there was 8 of those guns. There was one on each side of the gate where we went in. And then the rest of them were back in the lot. They must have had the ammunition there someplace too, you know, for them. So I went into boot camp. They lined us up, called the roll. You had to holler when your name was called. First place they took us was to the barber shop. Went in there and he took these clippers and just clipped all my hair off.
Shaved the bald head.
Just clipped her all off. Even closer than a crew cut. There were 60 of us. In that platoon, the 113th platoon, I remember. So then we got our hair cut, and so then we went to the quartermaster, where we got were issued uniform. I mean socks, underwear, everything. You know.
What did your uniforms look like?
Well, the khaki is there. It was. Oh, it was August, you see, in San Diego, and warm. So we issued khakis.
Did you get a khaki hat, too?
I don't... Yeah, Yeah, we got a little old cat like this. And I don't remember where we got the pith helmets. You know. Or, I don't know what we call them. Pith helmets. But I don't remember if I got them in San Diego or not. But anyway, there's 60 of us. Spent 6 weeks marching up and down the parade ground and around and running to chow and everything. And if somebody misbehaved, we were issued a bucket, yay big, to do our laundry in, a scrub brush and soap. So if somebody misbehaved, you had to take that bucket and go down to the side of the ocean and get a bucket full of sand. And they better have seawater in it and bring it back to the barracks. I never had to do that. I was pretty careful.
What did you have to end up washing if you were in trouble?
Washing?
Yeah. What did you do with the bucket?
Well, we called wash racks. Just rack a little higher than a table, a couple feet wide, 8 or 10 feet long. And you'd put a shirt or your skivvies on there, and your soap and water, and scrub it with a brush. You rinse them out in your bucket and hang them up on a line.
So now they smelled like ocean water?
What?
Then they smelled like ocean water?
No, we didn't wash them in ocean water. No, we used fresh water.
Then why did you fill the bucket up with sand and ocean water?
So the sergeant knew that you'd been down close to the ocean.
Oh, okay.
So you could just go outside the barracks and get a bucket full of sand. But if you went clear down to the beach and had to get seawater in it, the sergeant knew you'd been down close to the ocean. That was the reason for the seawater.
How long of a walk was it to get to the sea?
Oh, I would guess it's probably a mile down there, a mile back. Just guessing. So finally got through boot camp, took six weeks from it, but then went out on the rifle range, you know, and qualified with the old Springfield 03 bolt action. The chamber held five rounds in there. You mash them in from the top. And I qualified with the rifle.
Did you have to load the gun, like, individually, like
you
see
you
in
just,
the movies?
No, you pulled her back and mashed those five in there and pushed the bolt shut.
So it was a pretty quick process?
Was that World War One?
Yeah.
World War One gun, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, World War One. Like I said, the Marine Corps never threw anything away. We had to clean those things with sudsy water. Then you had to clean them, and then you put a light film of oil over it so it wouldn't rust. So I finally graduated from boot camp then, and we got a 10-day furlough. So it took me 3 days to get home. I spent 3 days at home, and it took 3 days to get back to San Diego. So I was put in a casualty company, they called them, and had to sleep in a tent for a few days. I applied to go to the field telephone school there, and they took me in and moved into a barracks center on the west end of the parade ground there in San Diego at the base camp. And I'll bet that splintery old pole that we learned to climb on is still there. Now, there were splinters all over it, and you had to learn to climb that pole.
With your bare hands?
Bare hands, but we had to climb it on our feet. But I don't remember getting many splinters. You know, fortunately, I didn't burn it. I didn't slide clear down. You know. There was one or two guys that slid down that pole.
You were just a pro, huh?
No, I wasn't a pro, but I was very careful. Yeah. So I got to Fields Telephone School and was waiting to be assigned when, in the morning of December 7th, 1941, a Sunday morning, getting along towards noon, the news came that we'd been bombed in Pearl Harbor. Well, that changed everything. They called us down. They gave us steel helmets gas masks, ammunition, and fell us out on the beach. We had to guard the beach. It made the civilians feel better there, I guess, you know, because we were guarding the beach in case the Japs tried to come ashore.
Were you pretty scared when that all happened?
No, I don't guess so. Moving too fast. Moving too fast. You'd be scared. You did what you were told. So then I was assigned to the 2nd Defense Battalion, which had just moved into San Diego. And, of course, I was a telephone operator and repairman. And we spent all of December loading 3 luxury liners. First, they painted them gray. They were pretty white, you know, when the war started. And they painted those mats and liners gray all over. And we started loading our stuff, 2nd Defense Battalion, which was put in with some infantry, artillery, and some special troops to form the 2nd Marine Brigade. 2nd Marine Brigade loaded on those 3 ships, and we took those 8 155mm rifles from the base depot and the ammunition. We took those with us.
On the brigade?
In the brigade, yes. So then we set sail, and I don't remember. On January 6th, we went, left the harbor, and that is a pretty place, San Diego Harbor. And it took us about 15 days going, and then sometimes we'd have an alert. They thought they spotted a submarine or something, and we were escorted by a cruiser, an aircraft carrier, and a couple of old World War I destroyers with 4 smoke stacks. And man, they could really go. They'd go 40, 50 knots an hour. And our ships could go at a pretty good pace, about 30 knots. Pretty good. But anyway, no submarines ever fired on us or anything. So we got to American Samoa about the last of January, 1942. Went into one of the prettiest harbors in the world, Pangapanga Harbor.
Pangapanga?
Pangapanga. P-A-G-O-P-A-G-O. Pangapanga. On the left as you went in was Blunt's Point, and on the right was Bricker's Point. And then as you went in, they a big bright red brick building was a missionary building, and the town of Pangapanga was on the west side of the harbor as you went in. So the 2nd Defense then, I guess I was in the headquarters of 2nd Defense. And we set up tents and our bunks for beds, you know. And we started unloading ships. And I found out that those projectiles for those 155mm guns weighed 102 pounds because
wow.
I carried them. And the bags of powder. When they loaded one of those things, they put the projectile in first, and then however far they wanted to shoot, they'd put the number of bags of powder in, push them in the back end, close the gate.
So that made it even heavier with the powder, too.
Well, of course, they carried the powder out a bag at a time.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that heavy. The shells were the heaviest. Anyhow, we got them all unloaded. And I suppose they took off then and went back to the States for another load. I don't know. And I didn't stay with 2nd Defense very long. The 7th Defense had been there since the first part of December 1940. They'd been there over a year, and they were shorthanded. So some of us were transferred from the 2nd Defense over to the 7th. And I was up on top of a ridge around Blunt's Point, but it was a tall ridge. And probably 500 or 1,000 feet, just almost straight up. And around that ridge then, we had an anti-aircraft battery up there, 3-inch guns. And that's where our telephone, there are two of us that went up there with the telephone. And we maintained the telephone then. There was a 50 caliber machine gun nest on up the ridge and higher up. 50 caliber machine guns. And I had to go up there a time or two and fix a telephone up there. Anyway, I found out later that a fellow from Montezuma had been up there the same time I was there. Of course, I didn't know him then, but I got acquainted with him later.
What was his name?
I can't even remember.
It was Jakes.
Huh?
It was Edwin Jakes.
Maybe.
Edwin Jakes.
I believe. Yeah.
From Montezuma.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice to have somebody close to home, somewhat.
Well, of course, I didn't even know him then. Yeah, I didn't even know him until after I got home, after I married and everything. But anyway, we were there, two or three months maybe, and we got orders then to form the 3rd Marine Brigade and move over to British Samoa. Upolu, British Samoa. Apia was the capital city. Then I don't even remember what kind of ships we went on, but anyway, we went on board ship and ended up over there. And on the edge of Apia, towards the mountains, there was a school called Iti Iti School. And of course, they must have moved all the kids out of there, because our 7th or our replacement group went in there, that Iti Iti school, for temporarily. And I don't know where they unloaded the guns and ammunition, because I didn't have to do that this time. I didn't have to be on the working parties, still on telephone duty, but didn't have to do that.
Why didn't you have to do the unloading duty?
Well, we had other guys to do it. We, being in communications, we got a little bit of special attention, you know, sometimes. Sometimes we'd be on some of these working parties, but not, we missed most of them.
Yeah, when you were down in Samoa, you couldn't tell your parents where you were, could you?
No, they censored everything you could. But anyway, I wrote to Mother about every month, every week.
Wrote to your wife?
Hmm?
Wrote to your mom?
Oh, yeah. Yes. She wrote to me about every week, too. There's sometimes a month before I got it, but then she wrote to me every week.
How did she find out where you were?
So, I was with we had to do training all the time. And I don't know, these artillery guys were marching up the mountain, and us communicators had to go with them. And of course, I'd been climbing trees all the time, climbing poles to put wire up. And I was in better shape than they was, so I got to the head of the column. And we went up this place, and there was a graveyard up on top, and Robert Louis Stevenson was buried there. So I mentioned to Mother that I'd been after Robert Louis Stevenson's grave, and so she figured out right quick where I was. But she looked it up, see where he was buried.
Like an encyclopedia, see. When she found out, then she knew where he was, see.
Anyway, it wasn't very long till we got organized then. And we moved to two guns to the north side of where they were building an airstrip on the north end of the island toward Suva. There's another island just across the way. You can see it real good from there. They moved two guns on the north end and four guns on the south end, which was A battery, and then on the B battery, and then C battery to the two guns that were left. They put in a mountain behind the pier, put them back in the bluff so they could shoot out and defend the harbor there in the pier. And of course, we had to maintain telephone lines amongst all of these people. And
what was your uniform of the day? What did you wear?
Khaki.
Huh? Oh, shirt, the whole bit?
That was the uniform of the day, but my standard wear was a pair of pants and a pair of shoes and a hat.
Your socks.
Didn't even wear a t-shirt. I remember one time I was stringing wire and went through some bushes and the darn bees got me. I mean, they just really swarmed me. My arm just swelled up like this.
Were uniforms all short-sleeved until it got colder?
No. Now they're all long sleeve. But I didn't have any shirt on.
Why didn't you have a shirt on?
Well, just too hot.
What was the temperature? The humidity, it was hot, wasn't it?
Well, not real hot, but as you move around very much, you sweat, you know. But anyway, these people down there in Samoa, their legs would swell up twice as big as they're supposed to be. It was called Mumu, we called it. It was a disease, filariasis. And we had a few Marines get that filariasis, and they sent them back home. So when these bees stung them and they swelled up like this, well, I went to the Navy doctor we had there in A battery, and I said, "See, I got Mumu. Send me home." He looks at me and he kind of laughed. I said, "No, the bees got me." No, they didn't. The only time I can ever remember being sick there, I got tonsillitis one time and they put me in a bed for a week or so. But we were, I suppose, probably 20 miles from Apia, north of Apia. The Seabees built an airstrip there where we had fighter planes could take off, bombers could land, take off. So I always made sure I found me a CB buddy because they had better chow than we did. I would eat chow with them.
What kind of food did you eat?
Food?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Spam, powdered potatoes, powdered eggs, powdered beets, powdered everything. And they got flour. I guess they can make bread sometimes.
Did you have fruit?
Fruit? Oh, yeah, I suppose.
Oh, not the bananas.
Oh, yeah, we had bananas. Yeah. You could buy a big old stalk of bananas for 33 cents. A British florin. That's a coin, you know, British coin. About the size of our half a dollar in florin, and it's worth about 33 cents. You buy one of these stalk of bananas for that. So we get the stalk of bananas hanging up in our doorway.
How was the CB's food compared to yours? I mean, how was it better?
What?
How was the CB's food compared to yours? Was it better? Like, how better?
Oh, I don't know.
Just tasted better?
Yeah, I suppose.
How long were you in the South Pacific before they shipped you home?
Well, I was getting ready to the next move. So, the CBs had the airstrip pretty well finished. And everything was pretty tame in that part of the Pacific at that time. So we loaded everything up. The eight big long rifles. Long toms, our anti-aircraft guns, and I think we had gotten new 90mm anti-aircraft guns while we were there in Samoa. I'm not sure. But anyway, we packed up and moved, loaded about everything on a Liberty ship, which was a freighter that was built during World War II. And it was going about 10 knots, slow thing. But anyway, loaded everything up, and we had a truck set right on the top deck of it. We had one guy that, if he just put his foot on the ship, he got seasick. So he rode in the cab of that truck all the way to, we went to Funafuti, which was an island in the Ellis Islands, and where they had already built an airstrip and everything, and it had a real deep harbor in Funafuti. So we put that Liberty ship in this harbor and they dropped anchor. Ready? Okay. Then they brought in an LST, a landing ship tank, where the front end had a platform that went down on the front end of the ship. You could bring stuff in on that platform into the inside of the ship. So they had a Caterpillar tractor down there, and of course they hoisted the guns over the side of the ship onto a barge, took the barge around to the platform, and the Caterpillar threw a cable around the gun and pulled it inside, the LST. So on one of those guns, the cable broke, and there's one of those guns on the bottom of the bay in Funafuti Harbor to this day, I'm just sure, because we ended up with 7 of them. We went to Nanaimea in the Ellis Islands, where the Seabees were to construct a landing strip for bombers and fighters. And we set up our anti-aircraft guns and our 155s. Although we just have 7 155 now. And we were bombed once or twice with the Japanese. Nobody got hurt except one stupid army guy took his damn head up out of the foxhole and got him on near the airstrip. Rest of us stayed down now. And we had a radar, a searchlight connected with our anti-aircraft guns. So the radar would pinpoint the location of the plane, and it would automatically cut the fuse on the shell, and then they'd load the gun, and then it automatically trained the radar trained the gun on the target, and they fired. They shot down one of those planes. And of course the searchlights came on and they could see it, you see. So we had to fall out right away on the beach and guard the beach in case them Japanese guys on that plane come ashore. But we never did see anything of them, so they probably lost. Anyway, we stayed there until after Tarawa was secured. And then a Negro battalion of Marines with white officers came and relieved us on Nanaimea. And we loaded up and went to Kauai in the Hawaiian Islands for redeployment. They took the anti-aircraft guns with us up there. Left the 155 in place there in Nanaimea, all 7 of them, all about everything else up. And within a month or two after we were there, where they split the 7th Defense Battalion up and set the 155s to the big island of Hawaii to form an artillery battalion. And of course we were issued new 155 millimeter guns. New ones, World War II ones. So we went over to Big Island of Hawaii and started training on those guns. And we were issued Oh, I forgot to mention that I was issued a Garand M1 rifle instead of the O3, you know, once we got one. But anyway, when we got up there and the new 155mm regiment, we were issued carbines, M16 carbines, which were shorter, easier to handle weapon. But anyway, I was there a month or two, and one day the commanding officer called me in. The one thing I forgot. Oh, no, that's this definitely. Called me in, and he says, "Say, I see you've been over here 2.5 years. And I said, "Yes, sir, I have." And he said, "You're going home." And I said, "Well, I guess that's all right." So immediately after that, and it was just about payday, they had a big crap game. They threw the dice up against the locker box, and I won $1,500 in that crap game. Very opportune time.
How did you do that? Just lucky?
Yeah. Yeah, anyway, I sent more than half of it home to Mother, and the rest of it, we spent, most of it we spent in San Francisco. When we came home, came into San Francisco under the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, went to Treasure Island.
Is that when you went to a restaurant and had something special to eat?
Huh?
In San Francisco, was that when you got
some money? Oh, yeah. We went to the fanciest restaurant in town, about 4 hours. Of course, I had this water money. And it went up to the top of the mark, they call it. Very special. You look out over the ocean and around. And I said, "I want a steak. That's this big, and I want 4 eggs sunny side up right on top." And the guy looked at me. "Okay." Best meal I ever had.
I'm sure it was.
Best meal I ever had. Yeah, anyway, I was there, Treasure Island for a while. And then we were transferred to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And I had 30 days to get from San Francisco to Camp Lejeune. So, of course, I stopped off at home. And bought a 35 Chevrolet car. What was that? So, oh, I mean, I liked to roller skate, you know. We went roller skating, and around Brother Jay was there, and we went together a lot of different places. Had a good time. Went on to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and I was an instructor in the field telephone school for a couple of months. Then I applied to get into telephone electronic school, I believe they called it. Anyway, I was in that. And so I graduated from that school. And then those of us who graduated then were sent to the West Coast, Camp Pendleton, California. And we got on the train then, near Camp Lejeune, whatever town it was. And went down the southern route through Atlanta, Georgia. And if we came to a town where we wanted to stay a while, we'd just unhook our car and stay there for a day or two. In New Orleans, we stayed there a couple days and ate at that famous restaurant there in New Orleans. Then we went on down to Camp Pendleton. And we weren't there too long, and then they shipped us to Hawaii, in Honolulu, to the 6th Base Depot. And we took radar gear and saved the components, condensers, transformers, all that kind of stuff, you know. Any electrical goods that were salvageable, we salvaged them. That was my job. And, 6 days deep. And my enlistment was up on the 15th of August. I was thinking about extending for 2 years. And then, lo and behold, they dropped the atomic bomb on the first part of August. I thought, oh no, I'm not going to extend.
That's
1945. So, I had to wait for almost 2 months before I could get a ship to come home. came home then. Came into San Diego and I said, I want to go to Stockton, Kansas. That's where my home is. They said, you enlisted in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You're going to Chicago. I said, okay. So I got on the train, and I'm sure we come through Dodge City, and went on to Chicago, Great Lakes, and was separated then from the Marine Corps. And they paid my way home and gave me some severance pay, and I don't remember how much it was. So then I got home just before Thanksgiving, and I got to watch Brother Jay play his last football game for Stockton High School. I don't think they won. Okay, you got me back home. Now what?
Well, it sounds like you had a very interesting life. Thank you for participating in my oral history project. I appreciate it.
Is that thing still working? It is. You want some more?